In this episode, we are going to be reviewing the film noir Odds Against Moral from 1959, which starred Robert Ryan, Harry Belafonte, Gloria Graham, and Shelley Winters. It was directed by Robert Wise. It was based on a novel by William P. McGivern, and the screenplay is by Abraham Polonsky. Welcome to Robert Bellissimo at the Movies. This is a podcast where I explore films from all over the world and how those stories were told on film. And today, my guest is Chaney Ryan, who is the son of the star of this film today, Odds Against Moral, Robert Ryan. Chaney is a senior research fellow at Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, where he focuses on nonviolence, pacifism, and critique of just war theory. Chaney, he's previously taught at the University of Oregon, where he was a professor of philosophy and professor of law, and co-founded the Peace Studies Program and the Master's Program in Conflict Resolution. He has also taught at Northwestern University, Harvard Law School, and Boston University, and he's also been named one of the leading scholars in peace and conflict studies by the Washington Post, among much, much more. So, Chaney, thanks again. I really appreciate that you took the time to talk to me today.
Great to be here, Robert. Thank you.
We talked a little about, we met in those film noir groups on Facebook. And I'm curious, because I know that you had said before you're not like an avid movie watcher, but are you a film noir fan in general?
I am. I got interested in film noir. Somewhat independently of my dad's movies, I was always interested in them, and then I started. I don't follow the Facebook pages avidly, but they are very interesting to read. And every once in a while, if they're referencing one of my dad's movies, and I think I have something that might be useful to people, I'll write in. Quite frankly, the people on these websites know a lot more about these movies, and they also tend to know more about my father's movies than I do. So I learn a great deal from them.
There's a great little story in the book when your father, I can't recall if you were with him, but when he was in France, as you know, the film scholars and the film critics began to coin the term film noir. And of course he was in a number of classic ones and people were bowing down to him on the street and he just thought that they were crazy. So I was curious, did he ever talk about when people started to coin these kind of melodramatic crime films as film noir? Did he have any thoughts on that in his later years?
Well, I remember kind of when that happened. I wasn't with him when that incident occurred, but I do remember, there was a period of time, it was later in his life, when it wasn't just film noir as a genre. I mean, what happened was that a few directors, the most dramatic one being Nicholas Ray,
right,
I think were suddenly being identified as great artists. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Again, I'm not a film scholar, so I don't know if, where Ray stands in the Andrew Saris pantheon of directors. He might have been
quite high. Yeah.
Right. But I think I remember my father, I think he felt that the setup and Odds Against Tomorrow Crossfire, he certainly had a very high regard for those movies. But I don't think at the time they were thought of framed in that way. Quite frankly, it's unfortunate. My father died when he was a fairly young man.
Yeah.
And a lot of the kind of regard I think that people have for him, that was not a part of his life when he was alive. So I've sometimes thought that's unfortunate.
I mean, he was so subtle And he can convey so much by doing so little, you know. And I really appreciated as an actor myself that he was really interested in theater and Shakespeare and Eugene O'Neill. So he was always looking for the challenging roles. How was he on the stage? Did you ever get a chance to see him in any of his plays?
I saw him a lot on stage, and I may have actually seen him more on stage than the movies. I mean, you have to remember that way back then, it wasn't easy to see some of these movies. I mean, when we lived in New York City, there was the Thalia. I mean, there were theaters that did, they would show older movies. But the acts, and there were, you know, channels would show them, but some of my father's movies I didn't see until well after he passed away, because there wasn't any way to see them. I saw him a lot on theater. I not only saw a lot of the productions he did, but I saw them multiple times. I think he did a production of Long Days During the Night, which was really quite good, and I think is very highly regarded.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he was playing an Irish American actor with a complicated family life.
Right.
So it was sort of a fastball right down the middle. I thought he did a version of The Front Page.
Yeah.
Which he was also quite good in that. And it was interesting because it's a very comedic role. And my dad, I don't think, he, first of all, he didn't do many comedies at all in the movies. And I now that I think of the two of them, I haven't seen them, so I probably shouldn't comment on them, but I don't think he was considered a strong comedic actor on film, but he was quite good on stage. Mm. Very, very good. Yeah, the right piece. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I bet. I mean, I still have to see the him in the Iceman cometh. I know the film version, and I imagine that came out after he passed. I don't think he saw it, based on the biography.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
But yeah, he sort of definitely was tailor made for those great O'Neill Irish roles. I just wanted to read something from the book, because for anyone who doesn't know, originally, Robert, your father turned down Odds Against Tomorrow because he felt it resembled Crossfire too much, and he didn't want to go down that role. But what he says here, that he changed his mind about playing Slater after rereading the script and appreciating its excellent qualities. He felt the film Odds Against Tomorrow says something of significance and says it well, dramatically without preaching. The drama strongly suggests that bigotry is based on fear and envy, and that the most important thing that keeps a bigot operating is the feeling that he is better than another man. And we certainly see that with his character, Slater. Was he happy with this film when it came out? I don't know if you recall, but I know you were only like 10 or 11 when this
I don't released. Really remember. I mean, I think he was. And the movie was well received, and he was lifelong friends with Harry Belafonte. So I think they enjoyed working together, and we have a number of photos and, you know, Ryan memorabilia of them horsing around, and he came over to our house a lot. So generally my impression was that if dad liked a movie and liked working with people, then that would continue on. And they discussed other projects that never came about, but they were very involved in the same political activities.
Right.
So I think he had a very good experience, and he'd worked with Wise before, and, you know,
right.
Like that. So no, I think it was a very good experience for him. What he thought about the movie though, I couldn't say. I mean, I didn't see the movie when it came out. So there was, and quite frankly, there was also never much discussion about around home. Not the kind of thing that we would talk about.
Right. And what was his relationship like with Harry Belafonte? I know that Belafonte introduced him to Martin Luther King. And as you said, the political interests were very much the same. Was that really where their bond was strongest?
It was. And I'm trying to remember. thinking about this discussion, Belafonte was someone that was very much in our lives fairly early on. And my feeling was that they were already friends. And they would have been friends through politics. So it would have been through civil rights activities. And my feeling is that they were already had gotten to be friends through doing political activities. And when Belafonte wanted to do the movie, I don't remember what Jones says about it in the book, but I'm sure that Dad wanted to help him out and, you know, support him and whatever. And then they remained friend out, particularly at, we moved to New York City in the early 60s. We moved to New York City after Odds Against Tomorrow was made, but Belafonte didn't live that far from us. So we then, and that was when the civil rights movement was really up and going. So we saw them a lot then, yeah.
Do you ever see Belafonte these days?
No, I don't. In fact, I was saying to my wife this morning that I've seen interviews with him, and he's still, you know, age whatever, going great.
He's in his 90s.
Yeah, I saw him. He came and did a concert in Oregon, you know, many years ago. And I went to the concert, and afterwards I went back and said hello to him. But I would, he's someone actually that if I knew, I figured out how to get in touch with him, I would just love to talk with him about the world and whatever, because I admire Harry Belafonte as much as I admire anybody, you know.
Yeah, and he certainly was really, really good in this film. Did you get a chance to meet any of the other cast members in this, Shelley Winters or Gloria Graham, or even the director? Because I know there's these great parts in the book where you met Marilyn Monroe and so many, you know, giant stars of the day. I don't know if you met anyone on this film.
Well, I don't remember ever meeting Robert Wise, though, you know, it's possible when I was younger that, you know, you meet these people and you don't know who they are. Shelley Winters, and we had the same babysitter, believe it or not. So Mrs. McCaskill, I still remember.
Oh, God.
They were friends. Can I tell you an unflattering story about Shelley Winters? That's probably the kind of thing movie fans are interested in.
Yes, we love those stories.
Now, my father was an extremely nice, generous guy. I mean, my father had never really had a bad word to say about anyone, but I remember him saying, and it must have been related to Odds Against Tomorrow, because I don't think they worked after that.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think it was only this film.
Well, when you're a film actor, you know everything about how to look good on film. And I remember him saying that Shelley was self-conscious about how her neck was aging, so that in the scene, she would always make a point of standing like that, because of course your neck looks younger apparently when you do that. And I remember my father either getting annoyed by it at one point or something, but they were good friends, and I never met
Gloria Graham.
No, I never met her. Now that I know about her, someone I wish I'd met. She sounds like a real personality. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. She was great, and she was in a lot of really great films. They did mention in the book, there is a mention that your father had to be, was really patient with Shelley, because I think her marriage was falling apart at the time. With Anthony Franciosca, who she was married to, so it was a difficult shoot for her. But again, if people haven't read this great book, The Lives of Robert Ryan, excuse the sticker, it's a library copy here in Toronto, by J.R. Jones. It's a real page turner on an incredible life from one of the all-time greats. So after watching the film again, how did you feel about it this time around?
I thought it was very interesting. I thought Belafonte was very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to be a movie actor, and the fact that you're a performer like a singer does not mean you'll be a good movie actor. I was watching. I was trying to think of the number of singers that became credible movie actors, and I really couldn't think of that many who could do dramatic roles. Yeah. And I thought, well, there were aspects of the movie that probably wouldn't interest anybody else. You know, when you watch a movie, like once I watch it, I'm always wondered about who the other actors are in it, because, and you're an actor, Robert, you know, most actors, if they have careers, they still never star in movies or anything. So right. most of your interactions are with people that, even if they've had long careers, you know, are journeymen, you know,
absolutely.
Or journey women.
Right.
And there were a lot of interesting actors in that. I mean, Richard Bright is someone that gets commented on, but Diana Sands was in it. Now, she's someone who had a decades TV career. And I kept noticing people that were kind of fixtures in Hollywood and wondering how they got into it.
Richard Bright, I certainly... for anyone who that name doesn't ring a bell, he was in the Godfather films and a lot of Marathon Man and the Panic in Needle Park, a lot of
Panic
great films.
Panic in Needle Park, right.
Apparently Cicely Tyson was in it. I didn't recognize her, but it's uncredited, so maybe she...
No, she's in it. The woman, I was interested in the woman who plays Belafonte's girlfriend in the bar.
Oh, yes,
I didn't know the name, but it turned out she had a 5-decade career.
This is, I think this is Carmen Delavalade.
I'm not saying that right.
Yeah. Played Kitty. And then right. Kim Hamilton played his wife, Ruth.
Right. And these are people that were all, you know, very, very strong actors. I would imagine that they probably, some of them had a connection with Belafonte. I was interested in whether there were other people in the movie who, like the screenwriter, had been blacklisted.
Because right.
Someone like Belafonte would have probably made a point of hiring people that were trying to get back on their feet in that way.
Right.
Well, I don't understand why it's not considered the last film noir.
This is after Touch of Evil. That's right. Yes.
It's not as intriguing a movie as Touch of Evil, but it is certainly a film noir. It has all the elements.
Oh, yeah.
It came out a year later. So I felt, what else did I feel about it? Well, I thought there were aspects of the movie that I didn't like, but were necessary for the time. I felt my father should not have been Southern. And I didn't find his Southern accent very compelling, but there too, that would be something that would jar to me in a way that it wouldn't, you know, to someone who's just seen him in a couple of movies.
Right.
Because it kind of conveyed the impression that it's only Southern whites that are racist. Now that was kind of first of all, the way some people thought back then, and also, if he hadn't been Southern, I imagine the movie would have had to spend too much time explaining why he was so racist. So I could see why.
That's interesting.
Make him Southern. Right. No question. Why is he racist?
You know, I didn't think of that. But because he's from Oklahoma. Because there's that reference where he talks about the wind blew away his land and his family's land, and he was on the move.
It also struck me. I didn't realize, but I probably hadn't seen the movie in quite a long time. I didn't realize how classic a film noir it was.
Yeah.
In the sense that the troubled characters in film noirs are war veterans.
Yes.
And they're war veterans. There is the same sense of film noirs are about claustrophobia, about trying to get out, trying to go something different. They're usually, when they get out of town, literally. Now in the movie with Ida Lupino, actually things work out fine when they get out of town.
Right. But that's on dangerous ground you're referring to.
On dangerous ground, yeah. But generally when they get out of town, it's usually because that's where the ultimate disaster will occur. And that struck me so I was struck by how classic a film noir it was.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly, even the using the blinds on their faces to have the bars and the shadows. I mean, that I think, you know, Wise, I mean, in the book, J.R. Jones points to, you know, those really being, you know, utilizing every single film noir technique there is. Even when your father as Slater, it was interesting that when he's at Burke's apartment early on, he's about to leave. And as soon as he finds out about how much money they can make in the job, half of his face is in shadow. He's was so interesting about his character is to me, it was more interesting. I love Crossfire, but Crossfire was a little more cut and dry in this sense. We know so much more about him. He was like this guy who was, for one thing, he was getting older. He wasn't very successful in any kind of work. He was, you know, he was let go of job after job. He has a crime, he has a criminal history, a crime record, and he's being supported financially by his wife. And at that time, you know, that would be that would make, you know, a man like him feel very, very small and useless, you know. So you feel his insecurities. And there's this interesting element, though, this scene where, and I'm curious what you thought, because he gets into this argument with this soldier at a diner, and the guy's daring him to punch him, and he you know, at first I actually thought that he was going to lose the fight. And then he punches him and knocks the wind out of him. And later on, he says to Shelley Winters, things are only go well for me when I get mad and things get easy. And I took that as, you know, he's only really good at perhaps being violent. That's when he's capable, but he's not capable of coping in the world. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that element to the character of Slater.
No, but I hadn't thought about that, but I think you're absolutely right. And I hadn't connected those two remarks. Yeah, because he's apparently killed someone in the past.
Yeah,
and, that was the one thing that he was good at, was killing somebody. I think that's right. I mean, he doesn't have, I think they tried to make him sympathetic as someone who, you know, the prejudice against Harry Belafonte is coming from a very weak place of, right, he's got nothing else to do. It's like what Lyndon Johnson once made a remark about how, well, the reason why racism plays is because poor whites in the South think, well, I don't have anything, but at least I'm better than
this
black guy. The scene the scene in the bar is an interesting scene. That's Wayne Rogers, he beats up, from the TV show MASH.
Oh, yeah.
Went on to fame and fortune in television. But also there's an actress in it named Zora Lampert, who's a very interesting actress. She was...
Oh, yes, yeah.
I didn't have time to Google her, but she had some, you know, important roles after that. I think she was a New York actress, you know, Actors Studio. Just radiates Actors Studio. And she's the girl, you know, that Wayne Rogers is trying to impress. I didn't realize that until I watched the movie last night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, she's been in, oh, wow, lots of stuff.
Yeah. Very interesting actress.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you pointed out some of the smaller roles, because I didn't know who a lot of them were, other than the major leads. I wonder if having the Gloria Graham character, you know, he has this scene where he sleeps with her. I wonder if that was intentional so that the audience would not feel for this guy at all, because the only time you saw his humanity was when he was, to me, was when he was with Shelley Winters. You know, he seemed to want to take care of her, and he wanted to do better for her, and you can't help but feel for him, and you know, she obviously cares for him. And I just thought, I wonder if Polanski, or I'm not sure if that was in the book, like, we cannot let people feel for this guy, so let's bring him down, you know, even further. And you know, when that scene happened, it's cringeworthy in that sense, because all I'm doing is feeling for poor Shelley Winters, who's out there working to take care of this guy. I don't know if that was your experience.
Well, I did think, I think you're right. I mean, they're trying, you know, it's very hard to have a major character that you don't care about at all. Crossfire, right. You don't care about Monty really, but you've got enough other people that you care about.
That's right. Yeah.
And I could see that they kind of thought, well, you know, this guy's on screen as much as anybody. So they needed to, they needed to humanize him.
Yeah.
I felt that in the interactions with Gloria Graham, he was almost charming, you know,
yes, or sort
of,
yeah.
You kind of see, well, this guy has some social skills.
Right.
Mainly to con people, but that added other, because otherwise, you know, he was just kind of sneering and, you know, unpleasant and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
hard to build a movie around a character like that.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. But the only one we know the least about out of the three is Burke, who's the person who, you know, masterminds this whole thing. I know him from Ed Begley. That's it. He was in 12 Angry Men and so many great films of the time. And he's this disgraced officer, you know, and basically is in a position now where he's turned to crime. And, you know, he was almost like either a babysitter or a father to these two guys who are wrestling and fighting, and he has to keep them apart. And then in the end, when he's there, when your father and Belafonte are saying pass the key, as after he got shot by the cops, and he just blurts out, I'm sorry, because he couldn't. This is the power of some of these film noirs, that they can make you feel for even a criminal. Yeah, at that moment, I felt bad for him. I wanted him to get up and get away. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's no, how you no, felt.
Yeah. He was a sympathetic character. I mean, he was a good character because he was obviously a grifter, but he was a Begley. I was trying to remember when I was watching it, because Begley had a very good career too. But
yes, I
couldn't remember. I do have an anecdote about that though, and I was trying to think of any Hollywood anecdotes that I could tell you here, but there is one literally about that. So in the movie, as you just referenced, there is the issue about Dad does not give Harry Belafonte the keys to the car.
That's right.
And that seems to be, I don't know if you saw it the same, but it seems to be that if they'd had the keys, they could have gotten away.
It seems that way. Yeah.
Right.
It's a little vague because, you know, Begley runs out, and unfortunately for them, there was a cop there. I imagine if it had been Belafonte, because he was dressed as the waiter from the restaurant, perhaps the police officer wouldn't have questioned it as much, because he knew that this person did a daily delivery. So,
right.
But because he runs out, it's hard to say, but sure enough, I mean, it blew the whole plan, you know?
So anyway, the issue is Dad doesn't give Belafonte the keys. Well, what happened was that one year in New York, when I was still in high school, actually.
Oh, yes. I was going to ask you about this, because it's in the book.
Listen to this. Is the story about in the book about...
Yes, when they're playing pool and some guys were bugging him, right? Go ahead. I was going to ask you anyways.
Tell the story again, but people should buy the book. It's an excellent book.
It is.
Yeah, no. My dad and I went down to play pool. We were living in New York City, and there was a pool hall. I think it was around 75th and Broadway, which wasn't that far from where we lived. And so we started to play pool, and, you know, it was a bunch of in the afternoon, and pool halls are, you know, just a bunch of mainly older guys. And pretty soon some of them started to congregate around the table. They recognized Dad. And then I think the movie had been on just the night before, because two people started saying, why didn't you give Harry the keys? Now, I actually didn't know what they were talking about.
Right.
but this went on. It was very lighthearted and engaging. But you know, and I remember at the time, I think afterwards I said, what was that about? And Dad said, well, they just saw Odds Against Tomorrow, and I was supposed to give Harry the keys. and this was, anyway, it was one of the great memories of dealing with fans.
Oh, I bet. And how did your father react to that? Did he respond to them?
I mean, my father was an extraordinarily nice guy. He was never took being a movie star very seriously. He had enormous tolerance for everybody.
Okay.
I never heard him be rude or abrupt to anyone ever.
Okay, great. So it wasn't that they were provoking him. They were just kind of joking around.
No, they were just joking. They were laughing about it. And I'm sure my dad had some funny remark about
it. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, because when I read it in the book, I for some reason it came to me that maybe these guys were trying to pick a fight with him because he was playing like, you know, tough guys or something. But it was okay. So it's good to hear it was just a lighthearted exchange with a fan.
No, it was totally lighthearted. Okay. And it was very, very funny. And it was all in good humor. And I don't remember. I'm sure if there was a bar there, it ended up with a few beers being bought.
Oh, great.
By the end of the day, you know.
That's good to know. The character that Belafonte plays, Ingram, was interesting because he doesn't look like someone in trouble at all. From the way he's dressed, like a prince, almost like a gangster. Like, he's so well dressed. He gets into that elevator and he's joking around with the elevator operator. And even though, you know, he tells Begley, who plays Burke, that he's in trouble with these gambling debts he owes, but he doesn't seem to take it very seriously. Even later on in the club, when they come and a friend of his gives him a gun, and there's I forget the exact line, but he refers to it, they're just kids or something along those lines. But that of course, as we saw in the film, was a plan by Begley to basically tell this guy, you're going to kill him tomorrow, or so he'll do this job with us, because as we saw, he turned the job down. But I suppose that's just that classic gambling addict. They never really take their how much trouble they're in very seriously. You know, it's almost it's like the old saying that a gambler wants to lose. You know, I don't know if you had any thoughts on the character by Belafonte in this film.
Well, if I had been asked to rewrite the movie, I would have made him more of a lowlife, quite frankly. It's a little over the top. I mean, he drives a very nice sports car.
That sort of was also strange.
No, he drives a nice sports car. Wife lives in a nice building where she's head of the PTA. And I guess what you're supposed to think is that, he's this kind of middle class guy almost, or assume, but just has this terrible gambling thing on the side.
Right.
I think the character could have been taken a different direction. I don't know how much time you spent in New York, Robert, but the single most unbelievable thing in that movie is that they're constantly parking in front of fire hydrants. I can tell you, having lived in New York, that if you park in front of a fire hydrant, you will be executed the next day.
Okay? I did not know that.
No one would notice it. And I actually know it because they shot part of it in front of this building, the Majestic. You actually see the name at one point. I literally know where they filmed it, and what they said to the city of New York is, well, we need to film this on the street, but we can't ask you to move any cars, so we'll just use the fire hydrant instead. You know, that way it'll be. Anyway, that's a.
I guess you got to be from New York or have lived there to maybe raise some eyebrows to that. That's interesting.
But I do. It is a very New York movie. It's an interesting movie in that way. They filmed it on location. Mm-hmm. They filmed it all on location because I remember when they were up in Hamilton, which is where they filmed the upstate part of it.
Yeah.
But there's real, you know, I mean, you're an actor. There's challenges because you have to talk the city into letting you use it and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. it must have been a tricky with those locations at the time. And I think at that time they had really just started doing that more in Hollywood, where they were really shooting in New York on location. That was very, very new. I mean, we saw that before, but it became much more common in the late 50s and 60s.
Right, right.
What I also like about the film is just it has this beautiful build. I mean, the three men don't actually meet to really plan this out. It's about halfway through the movie. And I, you know, for a part psychological study and part crime film, it's not what we're usually accustomed to, where it's a simple motivation and they're off and running and it's all plot, 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 plot. Here, and I always prefer more character pieces. And here we see, you know, the first half of the film, just getting to know these guys and all of their problems. And you know, they both turn down the job for different reasons. Of course, the character your father plays, Slater, once he finds out that Belafonte is a black man, he won't do it for that reason. He doesn't trust him because he's racist. And I'm not surprised that your father also felt that, you know, that this character was envious of Ingram. And you certainly saw that when Ingram, when they're all together and they're trying to figure out how are they going to get the guy to take the lock off the door, the latch, in order to open the door so that they can bust through the door. And, you know, as you saw, it was Belafonte's character, Ingram, who said, okay, well, let's bring a wider tray so that the guy's going to have to, and the camera goes over, and I didn't notice this the first time I saw it, but it's this beautiful moment where it goes over to Slater, played by your father, and he is just so jealous, and just because he did not come up with it.
I think Ed Begley goes, that's a great idea.
Yes, and he's so excited, you know. But that scene was great. I mean, just his attitude towards him. He didn't say hello to him. He starts to call him boy. He talks down to him. You know, it's like, well, just he says something along the lines of everything, you know, just he's very patronizing. Everything will be fine. Just follow the plan, boy, and whatever, you know, something along those lines, which sets off Belafonte. But I just thought the amount of patience this film has and this beautiful build with the characters, which nowadays things are so quick, you know, you don't see that as much. I don't know if that structure was something that popped out to you at all.
Well, I noticed that, now, let me say, I hadn't seen the movie in a very long time. Mm-hmm. So my memory is hazy. But I was surprised. I think I reacted the same thing. More in terms of that once they started to do the caper, it was very, very quick.
Right.
It was probably literally the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where everything up until then was build and getting there and whatever. And that was surprising to me, because now I think, you know, if they made the movie now, they'd probably do the caper right away. There would be some problem finishing it. So then they'd figure out, well, how do we do it again? And it would go on and on and on. Whereas this one, it's really not a crime story. It really is a story about these mainly two people who then in the end happen to commit a crime together.
Right.
Very interesting in that way. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I certainly loved it, and of course I love, and I know in the book J.R. Jones mentions this as well, the irony of the end, and after they both shoot at each other and they die in that explosion, and then, you know, as they pull the as they're looking at their corpses, and because they're burnt, you know, you can't tell who's who, and it's sort of, the irony is that these guys fought, well, I mean, I shouldn't say these guys, it was Slater, Robert Ryan's character, who didn't trust this guy, had all these bad feelings towards him purely for the color of his skin. And then in the end, it's like, I can't tell the difference between these two guys, you know, because they're both burnt alive, which was such the tragic irony of the story. But it's really a wonderful film. I think I liked it much more this is the second time I saw it. I saw it, can't remember exactly when, sometime in the last few years or so, but I thought it was great. I always recall Crossfire being a more interesting film, but I don't know. And this time around, I'm not so sure. But I mean, it's apples and oranges. But it's certainly these two can be on a double bill together. But it's really a wonderful film. I was also curious, because I know that, you know, your parents were both very private. Was it difficult to open up to J.R. Jones about them in this book?
For me to open up about them.
Yeah, was that difficult, or was it something you felt was important?
No, I don't think it was difficult. The problem you have, if you're someone like me, whose father was a movie actor quite a long time ago, the main problem you have is talking to people about it who don't know anything about the movies and whatever. And that happens because someone will find out, oh, you know, this guy's father was a celebrity. And then you'll have questions where you realize this person has no idea who you're talking about. Right. They're not really, they're only interested in the fact that they were a celebrity.
Right.
But no, I actually, and increasingly so, you know, am love talking to people who actually know about the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to, well, when I first talked to Jones about the project, and I don't know whether I had as great an influence on it as I'm now going to suggest, but he got in touch with me, and he'd written an article for the Chicago Reader about it. And he was from Chicago. And he'd actually gone to the same high school my father had gone to. So right. He kind of thought, well, this is an interesting project. And I talked to him about it. But what I said to him was, I said, you know, what's interesting about my father is the other things that he did,
right,
along with being a movie actor, because otherwise the story is not that interesting. I mean, most stories about actors are about they've been divorced 6 times, they were put in jail for marijuana, they were arrested for drunk driving. I mean, I read a biography of Nicholas Ray a few years ago, and it was a colorful story.
Oh, but, yeah, that guy. You know, yeah.
one tale of dysfunctionality after another. And,
right.
And, you know, I said to Jones, I said, you know, that's not, you're not going to get that story here. It's actually pretty boring. They were married all their lives. But I said, you know, what, so I was happy to talk about, it was fine. Sometimes people think that you're going to know more than you do about these things, or, you know, that your relationship to movies and whatever is the same as everyone else's. And that's different. And sometimes do they tell the Marilyn Monroe story in the book? I don't remember.
Well, yeah, there is references to how he helped her on Clash by Night, and then how on the Some Like It Hot set, and you were with him, how she was so kind to him because of how nice he was to her and defended her on that film.
Yeah, well, I'm bringing this up because it's an example of, I think, it's hard to kind of keep perspective, the same perspective, if you're talking to people about it, because I remember the Marilyn Monroe anecdote is quite interesting, but I remember someone said to me for a long time, and I think this the kind of thing that would come up with Jones is, well, that's an interesting story. Why didn't you tell that story or whatever? And you kind of lose perspective because it's just people in your life.
Right.
Now, what happened there, if you allow me to indulge myself, is
sure.
Dad was making another movie with Nicholas Ray at the time on the same studio. And I believe it was during the summer, because that was the only time when my mother would let us go to the studio and miss school to go to the studio. But what happened was that I went to the set with Nicholas Ray, and it was just one stream of profanity after another. I mean, endless profanity.
Oh.
And so Dad actually asked him to tone it down because I was there and he didn't. So my father got worried about, well, what's my mother going to think if we come home and I start repeating all these words I heard. So they were shooting Some Like It Hot on the next in the next thing. So that was basically what happened, was we went over there, and since Dad knew Marilyn, he kind of said, well, can Chaney stay on this set for a while? Because I'm worried about what's happening with the other set. God. And it's interesting because the scene they were shooting was the Running Wild song scene. But I didn't remember, I didn't put those together until many years later. All I remember was seeing Billy Wilder trying to teach Marilyn Monroe how to wiggle her ass. Literally, that's what was going on.
Oh, God.
Now, this is an interesting story. I mean, I've realized since then, well, that's kind of an interesting story. But with some of these things, either because you have different relations to celebrities,
right,
or, you know, it was just one of a number of things. So the challenge is not that you're, you know, shy or embarrassed or don't, you know, the challenge is more that you really kind of lose a sense of, well, what would be interesting to people about this?
I see. Right. Because these were people that you're at the time, basically your father was working with, right? Just like if someone else goes to the dad's office, they're not going to think that a story about that person is a big deal. But nowadays, you know, people want to know Marilyn, you knew Marilyn Monroe, you knew Katharine Hepburn, you knew Nick Ray and all these people, right?
So mainly what I remember was with Jones, who's extraordinarily nice guy and very good writer. He interviewed me one time at a great length, but even then I remember afterwards kind of thinking, well, I should have told him about this, you know, that was an important thing. So I would email him, you know, and say, well, here's some more stuff you would need. But my parents, they were very private. And my mother in particular did not care for Hollywood. And so most in the book, it's her achievements, which were significant. But other than that, I don't think I did or probably would have gone into any sort of personal feeling she had about any of this stuff.
Right. Yeah. And the school that they started, that school still exists, I believe, right? The Oakwood Public School.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think it's considered one of the top schools in Southern California.
Wow. And that's so incredible that I had no idea. I mean, I knew that your father was very interested in politics, and, you know, like people would say, oh, no, he played these bigots, but yet he was very left wing. And I always thought that was interesting, but I had no idea how involved they both were. And I imagine that had such an influence on everything that you've done since in the academic world.
I think that's, you know, Robert, part of the problem is, and this was one of my mother's challenges, is that I think that the Oakwood School, along with my mother, ended up in the shadows because of dad's celebrity. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Right.
It's just the way it is that if you have a celebrity in the house, and of course the children deal with this as well, everything is pushed to the side. My mother and my father, the school was my mother's idea, and she basically envisioned it. My father, in ways that I myself actually was not fully aware of till I read it in the book, that some of the things that he did to support it. But you could argue compellingly that the Oakwood School is every bit as great an achievement as my father's acting career.
Yeah.
It's had an enormous impact on hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
It's a wonderful institution in terms of its progressive values. I think so. I mean, when I talk to Jones, and now whenever I have occasion to be asked about it, I will always say my mother's achievements were every bit as great. But, you know, this was the 50s. I mean, this was when women were marginalized and whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And he was, to his credit, did absolutely everything that was needed. He was able, because he was a celebrity, obviously, to make certain things happen for the school. But the school still struggled along. I mean, the entire time we lived in Los Angeles, the school, I mean, it was stable, but it was never, it's only in later years that it became quite the success that it is now.
Right. Yeah, no, it's really, really incredible. All of the things that both your parents did is quite remarkable. What do you think your father would make of the fact that, you know, now Hollywood is very openly left-leaning at a time, certainly when he was around during the McCarthyism and the blacklisting, you couldn't be that open. So what do you, any idea what he would think of people being more outspoken nowadays?
Oh, he'd be very happy about it because you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a group of actors that could be asked to get involved politically. It was a very limited group. I mean, that's why some of them were friends. I mean, that's why someone like Dad and Belafonte were friends, is there weren't thousands of people that were willing to go to a civil rights rally.
Oh, right. And give a talk. Yeah.
No, I'm sure I'm trying to remember. I mean, even still, when he passed away, I think there was still, in the early 70s, there was reticence on most of Hollywood's part. But right. I read something recently that there's a feeling in the industry that in some sense, the political outspokenness now is a reflection of the feeling in the industry that that was a terrible mistake, a terrible time, et cetera, et cetera. That would have been great.
My last question I had was that your parents died really within a year apart, and you and your brother and your sister were all in your 20s. So I was just, obviously to ask how that was is a very complex and loaded question, but just generally speaking, I mean, how did that that affect the later years, the relationship with your, if it's not too personal to ask, I was just curious.
Well, I think it's affected everything. And I think it's only over time. My mother died in 72 and my father died in 73. So my mother was 57 years old when she died. Right. And my father was 63 years old. That's very young. I mean, I'm significantly older than that myself now. Mm-hmm. My mother's death was completely unexpected. So even though she passed away from cancer, it was very, very quick. And my father never recovered from that. Right. He simply never recovered from it. So he continued to work, but he never recovered from it. I think it killed him, quite frankly. I think what happens when you have that kind of tragedy is you don't process it right away. In fact, I went to a grief counselor, which was very interesting, many years afterwards. And what I was told is, well, actually, a younger person is not going to process it right away. They're going to get on with their lives and then go back and cope with it when they get to be middle-aged or whatever. And that's basically what I did. But no, it was the defining tragedy of our family, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And it had... I suppose the oddest thing about it was that I became John Lennon's landlord for a while.
Yeah, that was at the end, towards the end. And you were dealing with some people for those air conditioners.
Yeah, I don't remember if I told Jones about that, because when I first talked to Jim, I did say I didn't want anything about my subsequent life. Actually, not because I'm embarrassed about it, simply because I just thought it was irrelevant and extraneous. Right. And right. My wife actually felt very, very strongly. We have our own lives and right. It doesn't need to be there. But so I don't remember how much I said to him. But Lennon and Yoko were still renting our apartment. So when my father passed away, had to deal with, those issues. And the main one was I wanted to get our air conditioners back.
Right.
And this dragged on forever. I'm mentioning that probably because it's an interesting relationship to have been in, but also because, when you have a tragedy like that, you're mainly concerned with practical details, where's the medical insurance card?
Yeah. Getting all the estate in order. And there was a reference
I don't
to
think,
that.
I think after my mother died, I mean, I think my father, I know he basically didn't feel like he wanted to live anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was not as if, it's a tragedy to die when they're that young.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if someone feels like, well, they've lost their purpose for living, then you have a different feeling about it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, certainly they left a lot behind to carry on the legacy with the Oakwood School and your mother's novels and of course your father's performances. And you know, if anyone hasn't read this book, The Lives of Robert Ryan by J.R. Jones, is a real page turner and a wonderful film on, in my opinion, one of the great actors in film history, Robert Ryan. So Chaney, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I hope you can come again sometime and talk about another one of your father's movies.
Well, just let me know. It's easier when I'm in the United States instead of England, because we wouldn't have to do it in the middle of the night. But I'm happy, Robert. Please ask me again. I'd love to do it.
Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. For those of you listening right now to the podcast on the audio version of the podcast, there is only so many episodes on the audio version. So if you have run out of episodes and you want to hear and or watch more, go to the YouTube channel where every single episode I've ever recorded is on. I also am on Patreon. I have a Patreon membership. For those of you who don't know what Patreon is, it is a bonus content that is created by creators for the monthly membership with various tiers. I have a tier dedicated to film noir, Alfred Hitchcock, cinephile tier, which is sort of a general tier, which covers all kinds of European cinema, different actors, performers, and it is all based on polls that is sent out during the month that you can vote on. So you're very much will be part of the decision making as to what I record on my Patreon, and it's just a small fee every single month. So the link is in the description box below, patreon.com/RobertBellissimo@TheMovies. And lastly, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You will see it floating above my head right here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or go live. Thank you so much, folks. I will see you in the next episode.